Hello there, and welcome to Full Chats with me, David Prutton.
And me, Ewan Thomas, celebrating all things we love about being on two wheels. Full Chat is powered by Bikesure. As the UK's largest independent motorcycle insurance broker, Bikesure will tailor a quote to your exact needs, saving you money on your annual bike, scooter, and moped insurance.
Don't forget to press subscribe on YouTube so that you never miss an episode, or you can press the follow button on Apple or Spotify or wherever you get your podcast from.
Right, today's guest. This is a young man who has literally risen to stardom over a short period of time. He really is becoming to be a legend on two wheels, whether it's on BSB, whether it's across the Northwest 200 or now the TT. This man has got it all, and I can't wait to chat to him. Let's welcome today's guest, the one and only Davey Todd.
Well, Davey, thank you so much for joining us today. To say that we're both fans of yours is something of an understatement, and your onboard videos I find captivatingly terrifying. You've just celebrated a significant milestone, turning 30. It was my birthday as well this week. Don't worry, I'm significantly older than you. So congratulations and belated happy birthday first and foremost. How does it feel to be sitting firmly on the top table of both the international road racing scene and the short circuits with BSB? It's been a phenomenal time, hasn't it, my friend?
Yeah, well, for starters, I know you're going to laugh, but it feels old. something that I definitely was hoping that you weren't going to mention, but yeah, feels like I'm getting older. It felt like no time really since I was the young up-and-coming rider, and that seems to have, I don't know why people have stopped saying that now, you know, you're just a normal guy now, but but yeah, super cool. To be honest, for me, I remind myself every single day that I'm living the dream. I get to live my dream, and I try to be grateful every single day for it, because I get to race, do road racing. I get to do short circuit racing at BSB, race around the Isle of Man TT, which very few people get to do. And for me, what could be better than that? You know, that's basically what I've dreamed of my entire life, is not exactly that. That was a bit of a later plan, but racing bikes as a living was the goal for me since I think pretty much the day I was born. So to make that dream become a reality is just the perfect world for me.
I love the fact that you now say you're living the dream. You're literally doing what you were born to do from a young child. Surely this was a dream. I mean, the age you're at, the ranking you are in the world. Are you at the sweet spot in life? Because it sounds like it's going so well.
Yeah, exactly that. Exactly that. And I've always tried to be, like I said before, I tried to be grateful for that, and also try and enjoy the journey. You know, all this stuff takes so much work. I guess a lot of people don't understand the work that's involved in it. I think I sort of get the question a lot, or not the question, but people going, oh, okay, it's all right for you. You have a good team and a good bike. It's easy for you to get good results. But yeah, I didn't have that since day one. And not from a family with money, which is always hard to make it in motorsport when you're not from money, because it's an expensive sport at any level. So to come from a family that didn't have money, just a general working class family, my mum and my dad growing up worked super hard, sometimes multiple jobs to be able to fund my racing as a kid. And some mad stories where as like a 7-8 year old kid, I was at the racetrack on a weekend and my dad would be on call full time to try and earn more money, and he'd actually leave me at the track sometimes when he had to go do a job. So he'd say to our friends or whatever, one of my friend's dad's, oh, can you look after him and send him out when his race is on and stuff like that. It's pretty young kid, between, you know, 7 and 10 years old, 11 years old or something. And he'd go away, drive a couple hours to do some work and come back later that evening. And, you know, basically doing it all so I could race. So to answer the original question, every day I try to remind myself when it's especially when it's tough. And
yeah,
it's not just racing motorbikes. If it was that, then yes, it wouldn't be tough. It would be awesome fun and enjoyable, because even the training I enjoy. But it's everything else. Now running my own team or co-owning a team, dealing with sponsors, dealing with all the team organization side of things. And there's so much more that comes into it that, yes, some days it gets very stressful, and then I just have to give myself a bit of a reminder in those times of, you know, I could not live my dream. I could just have a 9 to 5, and then I wouldn't have to deal with the stresses and the pressures 24 hours a day. I could just deal with them from 9 to 5. And yeah, it's a quick decision for me that, okay, I definitely don't want that. I do want to continue to live my dream, and it's not so bad dealing with that, so...
What you're saying there, Debbie, I mean, because mine's a footballing background, Ewan's, of course, is an athletic background, but there are common themes in that. And I think you're absolutely right. There is that misconception, particularly with motorsport, I've felt from the outside looking in, that it is, people do sometimes see it as a little bit more straightforward. Whereas, like you say, the sacrifice of parents, of getting you to places geographically, being able to fund that side of it as well, because... professional football, yes, it's a brutal industry to get into, but you play in a team. These teams are parts of clubs. So already there's an established order there where if you're good enough to get into it, your world opens up and you're looked after in such a wonderful way. Whereas you on your own, obviously you want to get into part of a team, but A, you've got to be good enough. B, you've got to be ambitious enough. And C, it's got to be facilitated. And it sounds, if you go all the way back to where you started, which was motocross, wasn't it? With your parents there, It feels like it was just the right level of push, because inherently you sound very ambitious, and the right level of input, both financially and emotionally, and from a family point of view. Everyone was there pulling in your direction with you leading the way.
Yeah, so it was definitely me leading the way. I couldn't have done it, obviously, without the funding and support of my parents. You know, some of the races that I was doing when I was a kid were the opposite end of the country. I'm from a little town, Saltburn, in the northeast.
Beautiful town, Saltburn,
in North Yorkshire, and some of the races are right down on the south coast. And at 7 years old, funnily enough, you can't drive yourself, you know, 6-8 hours across country to race on a weekend. So funding and driving and all the logistics that go behind it are on them, but I never had, and you'll have experience in football, of every kind of competitive young sports when kids are younger, you get very pushy parents. Like it is I saw it a lot when I was a kid, and actually cringed a lot as people's dads were screaming at them and saying, I'm spending all this money, you best go out and win. And it's pretty bad in schoolboy motocross is one of the worst. So I was always really lucky. I actually wasn't really that bothered because I had that much motivation. But as I've got older, I've come to feel more grateful for that upbringing. That no matter what, my parents were always like, well done, you did well. And a lot of the time I wasn't happy with my result, and I was like, I didn't do well, I didn't win. And they're like, but second's good sometimes, third's okay sometimes. Like they never shouted at me. I never got pushed. 100% of the drive was always from me to win. I was always really competitive, and they were competitive. I didn't get pushed like that. And I sort of like that, because when some of my friends that were really fast motocrossers growing up, they sort of got to a 16, 17, 18 year old age where they discovered other things, and the parents maybe stopped pushing in that direction and went, okay, maybe go down the route of a more realistic career or just sort of let their foot off the gas, and then they weren't getting pushed. So, well, they weren't going to do it anymore, or not going to do it to that level anymore. Where my drive was always from me, so I always pushed and pushed and pushed, and I actually got to what would have been like 18, and my parents were always really big on work, so no matter how good I was doing at racing, they were like, you're gonna work a real job and a normal job and a good job as well. So they pushed me really hard to do well in school still. It wasn't like I got homeschooled or anything like that. And I had to get good grades. It was basically get good grades and do well at school. If you don't behave, if you don't do your chores, we're not taking you racing.
Which is fair enough, really, isn't it? Because I had a similar upbringing where my parents could see I had talent. And they were helping me, doing everything they could so I could be an athlete. And it sounds to me your parents were doing that and some. But I also had that sort of that tear where I was like, oh, I want to go out with my mates. I'm still young. I want to have a good time. But at the end of the day, if people are helping you, you have to make that sacrifice. Sport and going out don't mix. So I suppose you have to make that sacrifice. Otherwise, you're just wasting everyone's time.
Yes, I had exactly the same. And I know you mentioned the word sacrifice before, and that word means a lot to me. I've actually got it tattooed on me. I think I remember having that situation so many times as a kid, a little bit younger than that, where my friends would be just out on a weekday, even on a Wednesday or Thursday. My friends would not be doing anything wrong, but just out kicking around on the streets as you do when you're that age, and and my parents were basically like, well, you can go do that, that's no problem, but you're not going racing at the weekend. Yeah. Like you're either committed to it or you're not, like do it or don't. And it was never a decision for me. A lot of the time I was frustrated. I'm grateful, definitely grateful of it now, but at the time you're like, oh, but it's 3 days before, what does it matter? Yeah. And they're like, well, you either want to do it or you're not. We're putting a lot of money into this. You know, we want to see some commitment, which is completely understandable. And then, yeah, the same as yourself. When you get that 16, 17, 18, then there's other things that come into play there, and, you know, girls and parties and whatever else. And
girls and going out, that's what it is, basically.
It's pretty much. And yeah, it was just either you can go do that, absolutely, but we're not going to put money into your racing. And at that point, things are starting to get a little bit better. You're getting some more sponsors.
Yeah.
You're still having to find some funding. But I got made to work when I was still at school. I was working. I actually worked in Subway as like a after school and on an evening and on weekends, sorry, school holidays. It was like working in Subway. The sandwich artist, that's actually the job title.
I was going to ask the question whether it was called that. I consider myself an artist. Yeah.
And so like I just worked hard to contribute as much as I could and left school, still wasn't able to turn professional at 16, like some riders are able to. Wasn't able to at that age. So I actually ended up moving across the country because I got like basically an advance. I went to college for a couple of years and then or a year and then had a opportunity of an advanced apprenticeship, moved to Birmingham, was working because I could earn better money to fund my racing and go towards it. And just did that. But it got to a point after 2 years down there. So it was around 18. And I remember saying to my parents that was the hardest thing, because when I was at work, I got up the ranks a little bit just to earn more money. And it was a means to an end for me. You know, I was every second of my life, I've been set that I'm going to be a professional motorbike racer. Like there's not been a second where I thought, that might not happen. I'll do something else. It was just, no matter what I went through, and that those times were like, there was a lot of times things didn't go well, and you're like, that's all right, we'll deal with that, move on to the next thing. It'll happen. It just, in the case of time, and basically got to the point with this job where they went, oh, you can't have any more Fridays off. And I was actually racing. It was my first season in British superbikes, but in the stock 600 class, so like a lower class. And you race, you have to do the full weekend. If you race, you can't just do Saturday, Sunday. It's Friday, Saturday, Sunday is the event. And they went, yeah, you can't have any more Fridays off. You've no holidays left and whatever else. And I was like, well, I need it off. That's my life. I'll take it unpaid. I'll work extra hours at other times. And they're like, that's not an option. You can't have any more Fridays off. I'm like, oh, I quit then. And they're like, no, you don't understand. This is real life. You got to sacrifice your hobby for your job. And I was like, that ain't my hobby, mate. That's not how it works. This is a means to an end for me. And they're like, well, they didn't believe me. And then I handed my notice in the next day, and that was it. And I left and didn't know what I was going to do. It was a bit of a scary. This time was like the toughest time, really, because my dad was going through a really tough patch where he was out of work,
right,
and was struggling for work, and so my parents basically didn't have any money to actually support me at all. They did whatever they could, and they were like, basically, you can move home and work, and you can't go racing, you can't do anything. So I was a bit in a difficult position. So I was like, all right, I'm gonna just do everything that I can, where I can still race. Basically, I worked as a few mates at different periods, but worked as a tree surgeon for a bit, like helping out really as a tree surgeon. But he said it was for a mate who owns a company, and he was basically like, you can have whatever time you need off. How my story getting into the Alaman TT started was through this. So then I had the idea, I had some friends selling insurance, so like fracture benefit and income protection. So if you were like doing sports or you were doing track days on a motorbike, then you would get this insurance to cover your income if you got hurt. And I was like, that's a good idea. If I sell that, I can go around tracks and I can try and get myself, like, meet someone who could be a sponsor or would run me in a team. It's just a good excuse to sort of like introduce yourself to people. And basically, did this for a while and just to earn some money as well. And it was actually an even tougher time because that was at the start of 2017. And I had a tough experience with the team where they didn't actually want me in the team. I was supported by Kawasaki. But I'd signed for this team who only wanted to run 1,000cc bikes, and they agreed to run me on a 600cc bike only because Kawasaki made them do it because of the official team.
Right.
And there's no nice way of putting it. The team owner was nuts. And he would tell me this regularly before the start of the season. He was like, I have no interest in your 600. I'm only interested in the 1,000cc bikes. I'm running you because I have to. And you're like, right, okay, I'll just do as well as I can anyway. And at this stage, I still had to pay. It was an amazing deal, and this is what motorsport's like. It was the best deal anybody would get ever in those sort of classes, and I had to pay 20 grand for the season.
That's the best deal, you still paying 20 grand.
The norm would be 60 to 100.
Oh my word.
So yeah, there's people paying £100,000 for one season, one championship. Yeah, 11 rounds, couple of tests and stuff like that. So it's crazy, really. So to raise that money, I only worked flat out during the winter, and then I was selling this insurance on the side as well. And doing a bit of everything to earn a couple of quid to find the funds for this. Fortunately, at this point, I'd won a couple of races the year before, so I had some sponsors that also contributed putting this money in. And then we got this to the second round. I finished on the podium at the first race.
Yeah.
The second race, they rang me on the Thursday, so just before the truck was leaving to go to Brands Hatch. And they said, your bike won't fit in the truck with the other bikes, so you've got to come pick it up in the next 10 minutes. Otherwise, it'll get locked in the workshop and you won't be racing this weekend. I'm like, I live 2 hours away. Like, how? And they were like, oh, that's as it is. That's all we can do. We got to leave in 10 minutes.
That's how it is. So you 10 minutes notice, 2 hours away, get your bike or you're knackered. You can't do anything.
Yeah. Weirdly, I still, like, I don't really like giving up. So I knew someone who lived close to the workshop, and he was a friend and agreed to pick the bike up for me. And he actually brought it all the way to Brands Hatch as well, which is another 4 or 5 hour drive from where they were. Brought it down. I got some friends there and anybody who could help to give me a hand that weekend and try and do the race event myself. Mm. We did the practice sessions on the Friday, just the practice sessions. And then we're about to do the qualifying, and the couple of guys from the team came up and said, you can't have this bike, it's our bike. And they took it down to their garage and they said, if you're going to ride it, it has to be out of our garage. And I was like, okay, that sounds bad. They're obviously want to help now.
Yeah.
And then they went, your settings are all wrong in the suspension. We're going to change it. I was like, no, I'm happy with it. And they're like, no, we're changing everything. So then they changed the settings basically to make the bike unrideable. I went out and qualifying and it was like, they were trying to kill me. Like, it was unrideable. And basically at that point I was broken. Like, I came in, I was just gutted. I remember calling my dad and saying, what do I do? And I was basically in tears, like,
yeah, as you would
this
be.
This was my only opportunity. Like, this 20 grand that it took to raise that money, it was, you know, everything in us, everything in the sponsors, everything. And if this opportunity is done, then that's it. They don't go, oh, you can have your money back.
Mm. Yes, I suppose it's non-refundable, isn't it? You put the money in that, and as you say, best case scenario is 20 instead of 60 to 100, but it's still not an investment with an instant return, is it, by any stretch?
Exactly. So, yeah, it was pretty... He was like, I wanted to know what to do, and my dad just said, look, you do the right thing. Whatever you think's the right thing, you made the decision. And for me, it wasn't going to do me any good continuing. So I said, okay, I quit, which is all the team owner wanted me to do. So he could say to the Kawasaki that I quit, not he wouldn't run me. So he's got what he wanted. And then, yeah, and I was out. That was the lowest point of my career, lowest point of my life, where I thought, well, I'm done racing. I don't see any other way where I can go racing. I didn't have a penny to my name then. I didn't have anything because I've just put everything I have into this to be a success. And it's now finished. So I continued selling insurance anyway for the, you know, the next few weeks, hoping that I'd meet someone, meet a team. And I actually got a call off a friend of mine who was at the TT, but he wasn't racing the TT. He races BSB, and he actually races in World Superbike now, or World Supersport. And he said, you need to come over here. It's amazing. You need to come over to the TT. I was like, I haven't got any money. Like, I have nothing. I can't afford a flight over there. I can't get over there. And he's like, whatever you do, just come over here. We'll figure something out. Like, his dad was helping Sam West, TT rider, mechanicking for him. So my friend Tom was basically just kicking around, and like, he was sleeping in his race truck. So he was like, just come over here and we'll figure it out. And I was like, how can I get over there? And I had a bit of an idea, a brainwave, and I thought, I don't know, I'll call up my boss at the insurance company, and I'll basically say, we're selling insurance to bikers here.
Yeah.
Think how many bikers are on the Isle of Man.
Yeah.
You pay for my flights to the Isle of Man TT, I will sell so much insurance. And he's like, what are you going to say? What are you going to do? And I'm like, I don't know. I've never been there. I'll figure it out when I get there.
Leave it with me.
And so he went, oh, yeah, there's a flight tomorrow. You'll have to pack a bag and set off now. And I'm like, yeah, all right, I'll do that. So that was it. Packed a backpack and headed over to the TT on his flights and slept on the floor of Sam West's race truck for 2 weeks. And just, I got the bug for it. Like, stood at the top of Bray Hill just after the start line and saw the bikes come by at 180, 190 mile an hour. And instantly I was like, I need to do this. This looks amazing. Like, this is mental, but I would love a go at this. And to very recently, or to maybe a year ago, I thought that was a natural reaction for any biker to have that reaction. You know, I thought anybody would have that same reaction. And since I've found out that's definitely not the case, it's actually quite the opposite. So some of my friends and pretty much all my friends who've come over who've been British Superbike riders and motorbikers their entire life, motorbike racers their entire life, they've come and watched here and I'm like, doesn't it make you want to have a go? And they're like, absolutely not, no way. I'm like, oh really? That's not the feeling I had. For some reason, yeah. That was the opposite. I was like, yeah, this looks mega. I want to race it. There must be a screw loose somewhere.
I don't think there's a screw loose at all. At the end of the day, this was your dream. You said to people, I'd love to get to TT, and you did it. And I suppose it's almost like a movie script. The fact that so many people doubted you, so many forces were against you. No, you can't do it. We don't want you to do it. So then in 2024, you actually do it, Superstock, then the big one. Does that almost make that win, that goal, even greater? The fact that you had so many setbacks and doubters, you actually did it. I mean, I can see it like a movie. It's like a Hollywood script, your life. Does that make winning even sweeter?
It definitely does. It definitely is something I keep getting asked to describe a lot, and it's so difficult. It's so difficult to be able to describe that feeling. Because you feel all of that, you know, when you roll into that winner's enclosure in the Superstock race where I got my first TT win, to everything goes through your mind like a, I don't know what you'd call it, like a book almost, like flicking through the pages in your mind.
I can see
everything that you've been through to get to that point, and it's, yeah, such an emotional thing, and it's something that I'll never forget. Like, talking about it now, I still get the feeling. I remember the feeling, what I felt rolling into that winner's enclosure.
You can actually remember it. You can tap into it now.
Yeah, just anytime I talk about it, anytime I think about it, like I feel the emotion from it. I feel, you know, that just. Exactly what it's like, because it was just, well, hands down, singularly the best feeling in my entire life to experience that, and just getting to like relive that and talk about it never gets old, you know, because it was just all your life that's gone into working towards this. I know I grew up through motocross and everything else, but you know, I think it's hard to, in any form of motorsport, in any form of two-wheeled motorsport, how do you top Isle of Man TT? Like, even MotoGP is a 20-round series, 18-round series.
Yeah.
You know, it's not, there's the media and, the reporters and stuff like that will tell you that there's no one round that creates bigger exposure than the Alaman TT, because it's not a series. It's one event for 2 weeks every year, and just, yeah, so prestigious. So
yeah. Unique, isn't it? There's nothing, like you said, nothing like it on the planet at all.
How do you get anything close? And so when you win this race, it's just how do you top that? I wouldn't trade those wins for anything. And to having felt my journey to get to that, I guess it's why I feel, going back to the beginning, something I said at the beginning, where people say it's all right for you, you have a good bike and a good team, and I feel this like anger inside me, and I want to like tear the head off and be like, do you understand what I've been through? Like, yeah, what it's took to get to this position. It's, yeah, I've not been gifted it, not by
my word. If there's anyone that's worked for it, mate.
the last bit of the story I'll finish, because it's sort of the best bit. So in that year after the TT, I obviously wanted to do it. I spoke to Paul Phillips, the organizer of the TT, yeah, said, I've seen your race, you're obviously good enough to come straight to the TT, which normally you would go to the Manx Grand Prix first and show you're good enough at the Manx Grand Prix, and then you'd be allowed to go to the TT. But he'd seen me race at BSB and said, okay, we can have certain riders that come straight to the TT. And he said, I would like you to do that if you're interested. And I said, I'm really interested, I'd love to do that, but I've got no team, no money, nothing. And he said, okay, see what you can figure out, but we'll help you in the sense of learning the TT course and stuff, yes, like that, which they have a fantastic organization team now at the TT, where any newcomers that come directly to the TT, they give them so much support and so much knowledge from some really experienced guys to help them learn the TT course. So they did that. They fly you out to the Alaman, they get you a hire car, they get you some experts on a course to take you around. They help you a lot in that sense. But I still didn't know what I was going to do in a sense of a ride, getting a ride for it with no money. Mm. So then I just, you start messaging people, and it comes from a different area. When you're asking for a BSB ride, it's different. I didn't understand at the time, but now it's a very different thing. If you ask for, you say you want to do real road racing, is a different thing to if you want to do BSB. And there's a lot of diehard fans and a lot of diehard teams specifically that are only really interested in doing road racing. They're not interested in BSB, partly because of the cost behind BSB. It's incredibly expensive. Mm. A lot of road races, there is reward for that. BSB, there's no prize money. You get nothing. Yeah. You pay entries, there's no prize money. It costs a lot of money to do, and there's not really anything at the end of it. You know, yes, sponsors and stuff like that, but in terms of a prize, there's nothing. TT, there's good prize money. There's,
yeah,
a Northwest 200, another road race, good prize money, and start money as well. So you get some, if you're a well-known name or something like that, you will get supported to bring a team there. So there's support from all areas. So I then spoke to a team, and I spoke to a guy called Harry, and he said, I've heard you're interested in road racing. I said, I would love to, but I have no money, I have nothing. I really want to do it though. And he said, okay, there's a road race coming up, an Irish road race. So I don't know how much you know about these road races. They're like the grassroots of road racing. So the TT is a 37 and 3/4 mile course. Mm-hmm. The road's not wide by any stretch, but these Irish roads, they're on like back lanes. So they're like narrow roads, like single wide roads, with houses and trees and whatever else either side, and lampposts and what have you. And the mass start races, they're not, they don't set off one by one.
One by one. So it's literally like a scramble start.
Yeah, yeah. Still like there'd be 30 riders on the grid and you all set off at the when the lights go out and that's it, or when the flag drops, because they usually have a just a guy with a flag and drop the flag and
waving away
and go. But they're brilliant. There's such a great atmosphere at these races. And Skerries, honestly, I got a lot of shocked expressions when he said, look, the Skerries coming up, do you want to do that? And I went, yeah, I've never heard of it, but yeah sure, I'll do it. And he said, all right, I'll get your ferry over and whatever else. And to be fair to him, this guy Harry, he had no money. He didn't have the funds to be running the race team whatsoever. Had a couple of real old bikes that were falling to bits and whatever else. He was just doing his best to help me out here. And he had a sponsor of the team that was helping fund the entries and whatever else, and funders being able to get from round to round. But we were using cast off tires, cast off brake pads, like secondhand everything, because we had no like money to buy it. A new set of tires is like 400 quid, 350, 400 quid. Then it's more expensive now. So it was impossible. So we're like, yeah, I'll use someone's old tires, no problem. I'll make the best of it. But it was all I had. So it was, I'll do whatever it takes. And as I say, when I told a few people I was going to do Skerries, and they're like, yeah, where have you raced before? And I was like, no, this is my first road race. So like, Skerries is your first one? Are you mental? Like, you realize what Skerries is like? I'm like, not really. No, I've never been. And anyway, this back road, I think it's the back road at Skerries has jumps on it. You jump on a sports bike, and it
sounds really comfortable.
it's like a footpath. It's not like a road. So if you drove down there in your car, the wheels sort of touched the grass on either side of the car. So it's like the road's slightly narrower than the car width.
Just like you say, just a big pavement, big path.
Yeah, so it's a big footpath, really. So crazy race, but I was nervous. Obviously, then a few people had told me it's really scary and whatever else. And I went there and raced it and absolutely loved it. It was like, yeah, this is awesome. Got the bug for it, did well. I think I got third or fourth in my first races there. On these bikes that were definitely not as good as anybody else's. Yeah. And then he said, okay, do you want to do another one? I said, I'd love to do another one. And I actually won. So there's big prize money for these races. I say big prize money. Big for me at the time, it was life changing. So I maybe won $5,000 at this race for finishing third or fourth in the two races. So that to me was like, wow, like I've never had this. I've never earned prize money like that in motocross, not in BSB, nothing like that. But the team were like, well, if you want to continue, you got to give us that prize money. And I was like, all right, as long as you buy me some food and whatever. And I genuinely lived off, he'd just buy me some, like, a loaf of bread and some jam. And I lived in the back of my van. So I had a little Volkswagen Caddy van. So it's it's not a full-size van. It's like a car-derived van. And I had a bit of foam in the back of there.
Even a bed?
No, it was like a bit of foam because a mattress wouldn't actually fit because it wasn't long enough. You had to sleep with your knees bent. And honestly, it was great. I actually loved it. So I ended up staying over there for like, We did So we did Scaries, then we did Walderstown, another one, and that went well. And then Amoy, which is the race I still love to this day, one of my favorite races. And then the Ulster Grand Prix, which was my first international race. So I did four races, and this is over the course of not quite 4 months, maybe 3 months or something. I didn't have a quid in my bank account, so I couldn't, I didn't have the money to feed myself or anything. So I was just relying on these guys to buy me a couple of things and fed me while I was at the racetrack, and then bought me some bits the rest of the time. And that was it. I was sneaking into the local leisure centre in Northern Ireland to be able to get a shower and stuff like that. And
this is astonishing, David.
And yeah, it's wild, and it's funny. I feel like I've told the story a lot, but it's wild how many people don't know. And yeah, they were doing the best they can, the guys who were running me. But as I said, they had no money. So when I was doing well in race and earning a bunch of prize money, they were thinking, great, we can earn a bit of money and I guess try and do a better job. But like, I don't think any of it went into my pocket. You know, I was just
over. Well done.
I was just, yeah, can we go racing again? Because if this stopped at this point, I was back to having nothing again and not riding bikes, because bikes were expensive and I had no money. So for me, yeah, sure, I'll live in the back of my van for as long as it takes, you know. We'll just keep riding, as long as you keep running me, I'm happy. So yeah, I'd been 3 months in the back of this little caddy van driving around the country, and got to the Ulster Grand Prix, finished on the podium in the like a Dundrod 150 is like a famous sort of international race, and I finished second there, and that put me in good stead, as well as podiums at Amoy, which was Amoy's for a while has been like the top national road race, the top Irish road race. And I, in the wet there, finished second to Michael Dunlop. And I was like, Michael then was still God. And I was someone no one had ever heard of. And I beat I actually beat Michael's brother, William, in that race. He was third in that race. So I was in between these two, incredible Dunlop brothers on the podium. Yeah. And it was like a wild experience, and everybody been like, who's this? Never heard of him, sort of thing. And fortunately at this point, it grabbed the attention of a team, Burroughs Engineering.
Yeah.
A guy, John Burroughs, who's a well-renowned, he was sort of, other than Michael Dunlop, on the Irish roads, he was like the best looking team. Like he had a bunch of bikes, he had a nice truck, a nice awning, a bunch of mechanics.
So essentially a proper team and a proper setup.
Yeah.
And I was like, been over there, I wanted to race for him. Like if you'd have chose someone in the paddock to race for, you like, I want to race for that team. That they look the best. And after this Ulster Grand Prix race, I got a call, a guy called Bailon, who helps out the Burroughs team, and said, we're interested in maybe having you ride for us. Would you be interested? And I was like, absolutely, I would. But I'm riding for this other team. There was one final race left this season called Killer Lane in Southern Ireland near Dublin. And he said, would you ride a super twin bike? So like a lower powered than a 600, what I was riding. I said, yeah, I'd love to. It sounds great. And then at that point I told the team, Harry, that I was riding for. And he said, he fell out with me and said, right, that's it. We're done. Like, not running you anymore. I don't know if he sort of wanted to be out or what, but
yeah.
Maybe in another sense, he sort of knew that if I was getting a bit of attention from this team, I'm going to end up going that way. Because what we were doing on the budget that we had and everything with this team,
your ability and success is outstripping the people that you're with. That's the trajectory that I'm seeing from the outside looking in, Dave. Yeah.
Yeah, basically. So it was just, so he said, right, we're not going. And I panicked because I was like,
straight away, done. Well, if you're not going to carry on with me, we're done. That was it.
Yeah. Yeah. But we're not even doing the last race of the season. That's it. Like, I'm not coming anymore. We're not going to that race. We're finished. I was a bit shocked. So I rang up John Burroughs, who on the team, and I said, my team have actually just dropped me now off that ride that I had. Hmm. And now I'm like sort of panicking because Burroughs actually said, this is not for next year. This is just a one-off ride to let you ride this Super Twin bike at the last race. We have it available. So we wanted someone to ride it. That's it. It's not an audition. It's not a, we'll see how you go. None of that. Like that's it. So I'm panicking thinking, right, this is going to be my last ride now. Cause now the team that actually picked me up have now dropped me, and this team that are going to run me aren't going to run me anymore. So then what am I going to do? And yeah, at this point, I rang him up and told him the situation. He said, oh, I've actually got a 1,000cc bike. Do you want to ride that as well? And at this point in my life, I'd never rode a 1,000cc before.
Right.
But I was just like, yeah, absolutely. Sounds great. Like, I would love to. I've always felt like I'd be better on a 1,000cc bike. And inside, I'm like, this is not good. Like, am I?
Mate, always say yes first and then figure out afterwards how to do it.
Yeah, exactly.
That's your approach. I think, of course I can. How do we do it? Right, hang on.
I've always actually said that. Like, jumping in, for me, jumping in at the deep end and learning how to swim has always been the best way of figuring anything out. So, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, put the phone down and was like, ooh, this is going to be a hairy first time on a 1,000cc bike, and it's round like some sketchy back road. But anyway, it's all I've got, so I'm gonna do my best and hopefully it makes someone notice.
So was it 2018 you'd say was your first proper professional year, the year that you arrived and announced yourself on the scene?
Yeah, went into 2018, didn't earn any, I earned some money through prize money and stuff like that, but just about enough to get by on. And I did my first TT, my first Northwest, full season of the Irish road races with this team. And that's just what got me off the ground. And a kind family in Northern Ireland took me under their wing. And they basically went, we've got a spare room that you can live in, but just sort of look after yourself, buy your own food and drink and whatever else. And I thought, that's amazing. I didn't know them at all. They were the sort of new... Oh, the new John Burroughs, the team I was racing for.
Yeah.
And they went, oh, you can come live here, but just look after yourself. And then the first day I got there, and every day since, they just went, oh, well, we're making dinner anyway, so you may as well just eat with us. And they just looked after me like one of their own kids, and they were amazing, you know, the amazing family that took me in. I lived at their house all year, and because I couldn't afford to go like back and forward on the ferry or the plane or whatever, it cost too much money and it wouldn't be a viable thing for me. So yeah, I just lived over there and raced all season, and that's what got me off the ground. I went to my first TT. And I'd still at that point only done three races on a 1,000cc bike. And I went to the TT and became the second fastest newcomer of all time, behind Peter Hickman. So then all of a sudden people were like, okay, wow, this is something now. And everything changed. From that point, after that TT, I just started getting calls from every direction, and I went the next year, earned a good wage and got some good sponsors, and went and raced around Europe and did and became like international road race champion in 2019 for a German team, and got to travel the world. And it was like 2 years ago, I was living in the back of a van. Now I'm like traveling the world racing motorbikes. How quick things turn around. But
I mean, David, I mean, it's in the show and the way we record it right now, I've got a little bit of mid-show housekeeping because this has been absolutely fascinating, mate. If you haven't already, please press subscribe on YouTube so you never miss an episode, a great episode like this one. Or press the follow button on Apple or Spotify or wherever you get your podcast from. Now, you've mentioned Hickey there as well. And I mentioned him earlier on in the show. Your experiences in what you've been through to get to where you've got, does that then inform the decision to join up with Hickey to create your own team, 810? Because, my word, my friend, I mean, if you need lived experience about how to do it the hard way and rely on your ability, your belief, your support system, then is that part of why you want to be in a team setup such as this? Because just listening now, you've got so much to offer. Yeah, I mean, we're still talking about the off bike stuff, which will be years away, given your ability and your success. But is there a part of it that goes when you sit there, maybe with your old man, going, "Hang on, we've got quite a lot to give back here, haven't we? Given what we've been through."
Yeah, it's. I can't say it was part of the decision to do the team setup thing, but it certainly is. There's something in there that definitely helps. I was very hesitant at the team thing. We were just in that sort of situation where we sort of had to. It's something that obviously I'd never been on that side of things. Yeah, I'd organized a lot in the past, but there's a difference between running yourself and trying to run yourself at a race to running a big professional team with 20, 30 personnel. Like it's yeah, not really the same. So I was very reliant on Peter and Darren, our team manager, you know, to sort of take the reins with a lot of that stuff. Yeah, we decide everything together, and me and Peter 50-50 in with the team. So we literally own half each. But I was definitely having to rely on his experience for a lot of that. He's got a bunch of business experience running his PHR performance shop and running the PHR team that he's ran for quite a few years now. So he knows that side of things. And then we have a fantastic team manager, Darren, who's been a team manager for a lot of years, and the team manager runs the team. Like the team owner actually, when you get into these big teams, the team owner doesn't run the team. But yeah, we're trying to decide everything together and I guess rely on a bit of that drive experience. And weirdly, even though I was hesitant to start with, I guess when I'd thought about it, I was like, this is sort of the next step. I've won absolutely TTs now. Mm. Like, imagine how cool it is to win TTs and it be your own team. Mm. Your own team that you've set up with your mate, and we're both racing and both getting good results, hopefully. And I'm like, that, I guess, is the only way that you can top winning TTs riding for someone else. Mm-hmm. Is winning TTs riding for yourself, basically, or your own outfit.
No, I agree. It sounds like the perfect next step for you and Peter, if you can both make it work. Talking to Peter, how is he? I mean, we know he had that bad crash back in May. He's a top guy. Is he recovering all right?
Yeah, so he's recovering. He's had a few surgeries and stuff to right the things that weren't right. A few broken bones, a few things that are worse than that, a bit of nerve damage and whatever else, which is the more scary part to things. Bones heal, and it's weird. As a motorbike racer, that you shed such little light on, or such small awareness on breaking bones and stuff like that. You're just like, oh, it's annoying. It's not. Yeah. It's not a big deal. Oh, I broke my leg. Oh, it's all right. It'll heal in a couple of weeks and it'll be all right. I'll get a surgery and get it bolted back together. But yeah, things were a little bit worse than expected. But he's on the mend now. All his surgeries went well. He was actually on a bike the other day for the first time, just steadily riding around, not trying to go fast, not racing just yet. But he's wanting to be back before the end of the season and back on a bike and racing in front of everybody. So I need him back. I need him back for the extra data and support and stuff like that, because he's so experienced. He can help massively in that realm. But yeah, he's recovering. He's recovering well, and I think we'll see him back in full force by next year.
Fantastic. And given what we've spoken about and the sheer busyness of what's been your professional life for such a long period of time, do you get the chance to go out and ride for pleasure? Do you own bikes? Because we've spoken to many champion riders on here who almost kind of grimace at the thought, oh no, we don't go on the road. We'll do the TT 140 miles an hour. We'll go around Brands Hatch at whatever pace we can do, but I'm not going on the road. It's full of nutters.
Yeah, so that's pretty much where I'm at. Yeah, I don't really ride on the road. When I do, it's like something like a C90, something really slow, and something slow and just cool and retro looking. But I don't have any time really to do stuff like that. I ride a lot of motocross and enduro and flat track and stuff still, but no. No real riding on the road or anything like that. When I ride for enjoyment, it's motocross bikes, dirt bikes, and stuff like that. So I enjoy that side of things.
As we've spoken about, the kind of almost kind of Hollywood story with regards to where your life, professional life's taken you, and the people that we've had on the podcast, the likes of John McGuinness, Foggy's been on, Hickey's been on, as we've discussed, and John was really talking to us about racing at his age, and I mean that with the greatest respect because of obviously what he's done. I mentioned at the start of the episode about a certain birthday of yours, but we'll skip swiftly through that. And he took great delight, he took great inspiration and that competitive edge racing against younger racers, pushing you on, pushing you further on. Is that your plan, if you like? You talk about a lot of stuff being kind of reverse engineered of, yep, I can do it, then working out how to do it. Have you got that plan to just race for as long as you possibly can in the places that you've raced?
Basically, yes. One of my best friends. And he's been, as it is, unofficially, but he's said it in quite a lot of interviews and stuff like that, and it's, I guess, how we've worked things, but we're just on a good friendship sort of thing. But he's been sort of a mentor to me for the last, I don't know, 5-6 years now, and I don't think there's anybody better to have in that position. As somebody with the amount of experience that he has, but I just love the way that he goes about things. It's not, he's a very good businessman in that sense, but he races because he loves it. And ever since the first time I went up to John's house, it's like the best playground you could ever imagine for somebody who's into motorsports. You'd go up there, and I'd go up there for an afternoon or something, and we'd be like, oh, we've got this to do, or an interview together or something. And then be like, should we get the go-karts out? So he made his driveway into a go-kart track and tarmacked a hairpin at the bottom of his driveway. So you can basically use his driveway as a go-kart track. So we race go-karts around his house. and then he's like, right, should we get this? I've got a bunch of speedway bikes. Should we get them out in the field and see who can like go the best on a speedway bike? Right, should we get some pit bikes out? Oh, we'll go enduro riding. And well, you may as well stay over now because it's late. And then we'll go motocrossing in the morning. And he's like, he has the passion and the enjoyment and the want to do it that I have now. Like, he still loved it just as much. At his age, at his stage in the career, he never doesn't want to be on a bike. He loves it. Every single chance he can get on a motorbike and ride or race, he wants to do it. And I think that's the coolest thing in the world, to be at that age, what, 52, 53 years old, and still desperate to go racing. And it's been something that's really important for me, that, yes, it's my career now, but I do this because it was my passion and it's what I enjoy. Like, I'd never did this for fame or fortune. I just love racing motorbikes and can't dream of anything better. So if I ever stop loving riding motorbikes, then I won't do it anymore, because what's the point? It carries a lot of risk and not that much reward in reality if you're not enjoying what you're doing. So I absolutely love doing it, and I hope I'm exactly the same as John. I think we have a lot of similarities in a lot of things, and I'm not quite as tight as he is, like, but
he'll come to you, mate. Sorry about that.
We've got a lot of similarities, and I hope, that's what I've always said, I hope I'm just like he is at his age. I can't dream of anything better, just still loving riding motorbikes and not wanting to change, you know. I hope I'm in it, that exact position.
I love John McGuinness. Everyone needs a John McGuinness in their life. And that story makes me love him even more. But Davey, going full circle if we can, looking back at your dad and your childhood, the sacrifices he made, you know, leaving you at racetracks to nip off to do some work because every penny counted. Now you're at the height of your career and you're at the pinnacle. Do you ever sit down with him and say, Dad, are you proud of me? Look what we've done as a team. Or is it sort of like a father something, you don't even talk about it because he made so many sacrifices for you. You must be proud of him and he must be so proud of you. Do you talk about it, or it's just that unwritten thing? No, father and son, it's done.
Yeah, I think it's one of those. I think with most father and son sort of things, you don't exactly talk about your feelings a whole lot and stuff like that. And really the only time I ever have seen any real emotion out of my dad is on the start line of the TT and winning some big races. I think winning my first BSB race, I seen a tear, maybe one. And my first TT, there was a few for sure. But then on the TT start line, my dad's the most laid back person in the world, and so relaxed all the time. He's chilled out, not really fazed by anything, but I've never seen him like that on the start line of the TT, where I can see the nerves in him.
Really? But in his face and in his eyes, is that what you saw?
Everything in his, how he acts, everything. But you see that in the team. You see that in everyone. Normally your team on the start line of a superbike race, a British superbike race, they'd be amping you up and going, you can win this. Like, you got this, like, firing you up basically. And on the start line of the TT, it's the opposite to that.
Really?
Nobody says anything like that ever. Any team, any rider, everybody's very quiet. You can tell everyone's nervous, but it's the most pressure in the world for a mechanic as well. Like, if something falls off a bike while you're going around Donington Park, you're going to fall off and you might get hurt. If something goes wrong with the bike around the TT, there's a good chance that's going to be it. You ain't getting a second chance. So they all know that as well. And there's a lot of mechanics that won't top mechanics that refuse to mechanic at the TT because just it's too much pressure for them. And that's understandable. That's the toughest thing for those guys. And as I say, you see it in them, but I see it in my dad on the start line of the TT, and I know it's pretty tough for them while we're racing around. Obviously the senior race is just shy of 2 hours long, and they basically just have to, they're in no control after you set off. They just got to sit in the grandstand and hope you come back. And
it makes me feel, I mean, I've you've described it in such a way, it's giving me shivers there in all senses, because being a dad myself, it's putting your little boy in a bike and saying that he wants to do, not putting him because it's his dream. It's a collective thing and it's your driving passion. And it's, I suppose you go from being the age that you are now, you'll see the little kid on a dinky little motorbike about to set off on the seat.
It definitely wasn't part of his, it was part of his dream for showing me racing bikes, but definitely not the TT. And when I said I was going to do the TT and I was going to do road races, my parents did not like that. My mum actually didn't speak to me for four and a half months, because she was trying to put a foot down and say that trying to talk me out of doing it, basically. And my dad didn't stop speaking to me, but he also didn't, he really didn't want me to do road racing. He knows the risk behind it. And I think it will be incredibly tough for any parent to see their child do a sport like this, like the TT that carries that sort of inherent danger and that sort of risk. But at the same time, he always supports it. And, you know, I think now he loves it. I think it's so cool to be in that situation now that he's still working really hard as he always has. But whenever he's not at work, he's at every race. He doesn't miss one. He loves it. He never misses the TT. It's the only one that he's like, every year I'm coming for the full 2 weeks. I don't want to miss a day.
Yeah.
I want to be there. So it's really cool. And I think there has been that. We've spoke vaguely about things and I think it is really nice. And I just, now I'm really grateful to be in a position and I think I'll spend the rest of my life repaying him for the sacrifice he made to get me to this point, you know, because without him and my mom and my grandparents, to be fair, that I wouldn't be in this position. So now my dad still loves bikes and he never had, from basically when I started racing competitively, so my second or third year, 7 or 8 years old, my dad had a bike, and just a real old bike that wasn't worth a lot, but he had to sell it because to help pay for my racing.
Yeah.
And basically from then until, like 2018, 19, when I was starting to do well on my own and look after my own career and stuff, that was the first time that he was able to get a bike again. And he's been bike obsessed his entire life. So he's not had anything. My mum didn't have clothes or handbags or nothing nice. We didn't eat out. We didn't, as a family, it was a crazy dynamic. My parents went without a lot for me to be able to do what I do. And now, especially my old man, now he can have bikes again. I'm able to call on sponsors or even just get him some nice riding kit and a nice helmet and some boots and all this stuff that he always had, old gear and not very nice stuff. And so he's really happy to be able to have stuff like that and come along to some races and just enjoy it now. And I think he really enjoys that.
Yeah, I bet he does. Now, before you let you go, Davey, here's one for you. What advice would the Davey Todd of today give the sandwich artist in Subway all those years ago?
You know what? It's so tough to actually give any advice that would really change a whole lot. Because you know what? Like when I was living in the back of my van in Ireland without a penny to my name, I was loving it. You know, I can't say that it was the grind and it was horrendous and you know, anything like that. It doesn't sound great now, don't get me wrong, but at the time, I was getting to live the dream. You know, the only thing in my life that would have been horrendous is not racing motorbikes.
Yeah.
And I was getting to do that. So it was brilliant. And I feel like I genuinely enjoyed the journey every step of the way, because I was, you know, loving what I was doing every step of the way. I was racing bikes, even in that situation. Some of them I definitely wouldn't ride again, because they're not incredibly safe.
Yeah.
There's bits falling off them and what have you. But in the situation at the time, I was prepared to take that risk and overlook it, and for the opportunity that I had. So I was happy. I wasn't scared. I wasn't sort of nervous. I was really enjoying it. That was the main thing. The main advice I give to anybody else is to enjoy it. You know, any other younger riders and stuff like that, is you're not enjoying it, what are you doing? Like, don't be so serious about it. You see so many kids at a young age that are very serious, like almost the parents or whatever, they think they should have a focused, serious mindset on it. And I was focused, I was driven, I made the sacrifices, I had fun. Like, I didn't take away it was still fun to me making the sacrifice, because I was still doing what I wanted to do.
Yeah.
So have fun is the out and out, the most important thing for me.
I mean, what a way to sign off the back of what has been a truly amazing chat, Davey. It's been a privilege. It's you come into this, and as I said, we have so many wonderful guests on this, and there's that trepidation of what you're going to get, but you've given us so much. That you've been very, very kind with your time, and just very kind in the sense of being so open and honest about it all, because it's just been fascinating. And when you say privilege, it's been a genuine privilege, Dave. It's one of those ones that's really going to stick in my memory and Ewan's, I'm sure.
Absolutely. It's been brilliant.
Sadly, unfortunately, that's about it for this week's full chat. We've had too much of David Todd's time. This one's been powered by Bikeshop, as it always is, of course, as UK's largest independent motorcycle insurance broker. Bikeshop will tailor a quote to your exact needs and help save you money on your annual bike, scooter or moped insurance.
A huge thanks to today's special guest. Honestly, I almost feel like a proud father. He's been awesome. The one and only Davey Todd.
Thanks for having me.
Yep, it's been an absolute pleasure, Davey. Please don't forget to press the subscribe button on YouTube so that you never miss an episode, or press the follow button on Apple or Spotify or wherever you get your podcast from.
Thanks so much for listening. Until next time, goodbye.